as Jennifer said, I'm quite happy for really negative criticisms to come out in a constructive manner, if you know what I mean. Okay. So it's good to be here, and I just want to say it was at a previous Hope and Resistance gathering in 1997 that I presented the original outline of the Trident Ploughshares 2000 campaign. So it's good to be here now to try to evaluate it all with you. It started with an unsolicited letter so titled "To Protect People from Possible Conspiracy Charges." And this was sent to personal contacts on the 1st of June in 1997. From that initial mailing, the first core group was formed, and we now have 12 people in the core group, and the campaign is stable and not dependent on any one individual or group. We produced invitations to join the campaign, set up non-violence trainings, produced a handbook and video, and planned the first disarmament camp. We formed a dialogue and negotiation team which produced the first open letter to the Prime Minister on the 18th of March 1998, and which has been sending regular 3-monthly letters ever since. This group contains people connected at an international level with the Conference on Disarmament, the Middle Powers Initiative and the New Agenda Coalition, so that the information and the requests made to the UK government are consistent with the international peace movement lobbying. We work cooperatively with several other organisations like the World Corp Project, CND and Global 2000, and have kept up a constant stream of parliamentary questions which are now yielding some useful answers. We encourage parliamentarians to sign our petition of support and now have 60, including 12 from the new Scottish Parliament. They help get answers to our letters, ask questions for us, and are now beginning to join us in our disarmament actions. The petitions of support for organisations, famous people or individuals to sign are very similar to the pledge that each Trident Ploughshares pledger signs and are thus a good indication of the general support that the campaign is getting. They are yielding a spectrum of support from many different parts of society that we can publicise so that we can't be easily marginalised. We recently had the Archbishop of Wales, Rowan Williams, sign our support. From an initial small grant from the Seeds of Hope Ploughshares Group, we're now regularly receiving grants from several organisations and also generate a substantial portion of our finances from the sale of resources and donations from the readers of our publication Speed the Plough. We have a budget of around £16,000 now, and this pays for the 4 disarmament camps that we put on each year, the ongoing administrative and communication work, plus the press and legal support work. Since Trident Ploughshares began its disarmament work in August 1998, after a formal launch in May 1998, there have been 546 arrests, mainly at the disarmament camps held every 3 months at Coalport and Faslane in Scotland. There have been over 50 trials completed, and 730 days have been spent in prison, not including the days in police custody. We now have 163 global citizens from 13 different countries who have pledged to prevent nuclear crime and have taken part in a 2-day workshop on non-violence. Having citizens from other countries joining in our disarmament work with us, appearing in the courts and spending time in our prisons, has been much harder for the authorities to deal with. The government and the courts like to pretend that British nuclear weapons are purely a British affair, but they find this position untenable when foreigners appear in court to explain why they feel threatened by Britain and why they are joining with many other nationalities as global citizens and why they have pledged to peacefully disarm British Trident. The pledge is based upon our right under international law to take non-violent, accountable and safe actions to disarm the British Trident nuclear weapons system. The pledge and the common training form the basis of our ability to cooperate safely and easily with other pledgers when we come together in the camps. We may not personally know each other, but we know we share a common basis for action. We make sure our plans, motivations and organisational structures are open to the public, the government and military. We have a website which contains all our materials, including our Tridenting It handbook. We send regular updated lists of all the pledges to the government, along with continued requests for dialogue and negotiation. We've even suggested to the Attorney General and the Lord Advocate that they should arrest all the pledgers if they think we are conspiring to commit crimes, but that in our opinion it is the government and military who should be arrested for grave breaches of international humanitarian law. We work in this safe, open and accountable manner consistent with our vision of what we'd like to see in its place. Our careful reliance upon non-violence and open accountability have led to very good relations with the general public and with the civil police, who are noting the embarrassment of the Ministry of Defence as we regularly breach the high security areas, gain access to military police boats to do citizens' war crime inspections, and swim onto supposedly secure nuclear submarines. As a measure of our good relations with the civil police, I take it as a vote of confidence that after initial suspicions from the police around Aldermaston in the run-up to the camp that starts this Thursday, they took our advice and visited the police around Faslane and have since been much more amenable to discussion and have even helped with some car parking suggestions. All pledgers have to be in affinity groups and agree to the safety and non-violence ground rules, but thereafter work as autonomously as they wish. And they have chosen various kinds of disarmament actions, which have ranged from blockades to fence cutting, to swimming onto the submarines and destroying equipment, to dismantling a research lab, to painting war crime warnings on military equipment, and handing out leaflets to military base workers urging them to refuse to be a war criminal. We encourage as much diverse and active disarmament work as possible, as long as it is safe and peaceful. As individuals and groups have got to know each other at the camps, there have been much more creativity and spontaneous action, and more groups are planning and carrying out joint actions. Several groups have folded, and there has been a rearrangement of people within groups as individuals find the kind of people that they find that they're more at ease with and work with better. Of the roughly 25 affinity groups, around 14 are very active. The majority of the disarmament actions have caused minimal damage for maximum court-clogging disruption. There have also been at least 6 attempts at substantial disarmament damage, with 2 groups managing to complete their actions, causing hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of damage and delaying the operation of the Trident-related equipment. In February of 1999, for instance, Rachel...
We've got some infiltration there.
In February of 1999, Rachel and Rosie swam onto Vengeance and destroyed the testing equipment on the conning tower. Their trial will be heard in Manchester in September. We call all of this damage disarmament and nuclear crime prevention. The effect of all the cases at Killensborough has been cumulative, and more local people are getting involved. The ample sprinkling of foreign nationals keeps the international perspective to the fore, so that the whole campaign does not become stultified by parochialism. It took a patient amount of regular and solid press work before the press caught on. The Greenock victory pushed the campaign into the limelight in Scotland, and the nuclear weapons issue is now back on the agenda there. The political...
Can you just say what the Greenock... carry on, and I'll ask
The political furore continues with resolutions and notices in the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Assembly, where I'm speaking at a meeting tomorrow, and at Westminster supporting our acquittal. It's interesting to examine why our acquittal at Greenock is still causing ripples. I think it's because the law has traditionally been used against the people rather than the state. Yet now the people, the Trident Ploughshares pledgers, have turned this around and have openly challenged the whole legal basis and thus legitimacy of the armed forces. Such a challenge has of course been mounted many times over the last 55 years of anti-nuclear campaigning. Nuclear weapons have always been unlawful, and the Shimoda case in Tokyo in the 60s showed very clearly that the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings were war crimes. However, few citizens' campaigns have used the law in such a pointed and consistent manner as Trident Ploughshares. We have based our whole campaign on international law and have used it to delegitimise nuclear weapons and to legitimise our own actions, and we have done it in a highly public and confrontational manner so it cannot be ignored. And we have kept the moral arguments to the fore as well by emphasising the links between morality and the law. It is worth pointing out that although the campaign is based on international law, any individual within the campaign is free to choose whether to use this or not, and many campaigners never mention international law, preferring to use their own personal or moral arguments. This adds vitality and diversity and strengthens our aim of autonomy and self-sufficiency. However, it is true to say that Trident Ploughshares as a whole, uses the ICJ advisory opinion of 1996 as a strong legal foundation and can be seen as a way to implement this opinion and to pressurise our governments to uphold international law. Our argument is very straightforward. Nuclear weapons are weapons of mass destruction and thus cannot be used with any precision or any pretense at righting any wrong. It is basically mass murder on a catastrophic scale with the potential for escalation to the use of thousands of nuclear weapons which could put an end to all life on Earth. Law is based upon morality and is respected insofar and only insofar as it conforms to common human morality. Governments, soldiers and armed forces gain their legitimacy and power from the law, and thus the law is of immense importance to them. The only thing that distinguishes a soldier from a common murderer is that he has been given legal permission to do certain kinds of killing on behalf of society. His legalised killing is carefully controlled by laws, the most important of which are international humanitarian laws. Our acquittal at Greenock cleared us of criminal intent and at the same time clearly pointed out the criminal intent of the British nuclear forces. The acquittal has encouraged many more people to join in the disarmament work and to feel confident about saying that they are preventing crime, not causing it. When Tommy Sheridan, the Scottish Socialist Party member of the Scottish Parliament, was in court for his plea hearing after blockading with us in February, he confidently stated that he was upholding international law and wondered why he was being charged at all, considering he would have been treated as a hero if he had disarmed a gunman in the high street. In view of all the controversy, the government have been forced to institute a very rare legal process in Scotland called a Lord Advocate's Reference. This is because our acquittal cannot be appealed, and they are challenging it by the back door in this manner to try to stop any other judges giving similar acquittals. The process is meant to be an inquisitorial one, whereby certain questions are put to the High Court judges by the Lord Advocate for them to clarify the law. The validity of citizens acting to prevent international crime in Scotland, as well as the content of international law, should come under scrutiny. It is essential in any democracy that the judicial system is willing and able to impartially examine the legality of all official government policies, but this will need a sustained application of pressure. Each obstacle put in our way gives us a chance to come up with more creative ways of keeping the issue in the public mind and gaining more and more support. With enough people, and not that many, maybe 1,000 would be enough, we can stop Baselay being able to operate at all. Our disarmament actions continue. Our last action was on February the 14th when we succeeded in blocking all road entrances into the Faslane base for several hours. There were 185 arrests, including 10 church ministers and 2 parliamentarians. To conclude, we've made a reasonable start. In 2 years, we have established a good network of non-violent and accountable activists who are committed to sustained disarmament work. We're still growing and generating energy and enthusiasm, and nuclear disarmament is back on the public and political agenda. We have had a major court victory, and a wide spectrum of respected public figures are now openly supporting us. Considering that all the work is done voluntarily with a minimum of resources, we've managed quite well. The major problems facing us are how to keep and expand the number of pledges, and especially the foreign nationals. How to enable more groups to plan and carry out maximum disarmament actions. How to keep the pressure on in Scotland whilst trying to have more impact in England. How to keep the quality of work up whilst decentralising. How to improve the communications between groups and individuals. And how to improve the democratic decision-making process whilst ensuring the campaign functions smoothly without demanding a greater level of time and participation than campaigners are willing to give. No, at the moment what happens is that at each of the 6 monthly reps meetings, not at each of them, but once a year, they decide whether they're going on for another year or not, which is not a very sustainable way of running a campaign, I don't think, but at the moment that's what we've got to. So this meeting, there's a meeting in mid-June, and the reps there will decide whether they want to carry on for another year or not.
So far the decision is to carry on this year?
Yeah, right. Yeah, to the end of this year.
Okay.
And there was a decision made, I think, the last reps meeting or the meeting before, that it would be called Trident Ploughshares from now on, rather than Trident Ploughshares 2000. And as the materials run out, the 2000 will be dropped. But the two names are used together at the moment.
I'm sorry, I was late. You might have said this already, so don't say it again if you have. Just clarify the decision-making structure through the campaign.
There's a reps meeting every 6 months, where one or two reps, sometimes more, but we try to keep it to two reps per affinity group, are meant to send representatives, where anything that any group wants to raise can be raised, and the decisions for the next 6 months are meant to be made, where they check in whether they like the work of the people doing the work or who are in the core group or doing various, taking on various bits of responsibility. And usually there's a sort of a whole load of questions that goes out to different groups, and they're meant to discuss that in their affinity group, send a rep to the meeting, and then the decisions are made at that rep's meeting. And if they can't get to the meeting, at least to send in a written written answers to those questions. And then by consensus in that rep's meeting, the decisions are made for the next 6 months, which the core group are then meant to implement in various ways.
Is it like majority voting then, or is it veto right or any other kind of structure?
There's no voting. Mm. It's done by consensus.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Yes, everybody has a different idea of what that means.
Except for you, I mean.
In that
meeting.
It means that you carry on in that meeting until you come to some kind of decision. Mm. Now, as the meetings actually only take part over a weekend, in practice, and if I'm being really critical about it, which I want to be in this kind of group, I would say our facilitation of consensus-making decisions is very poor, and that the process in the those reps meetings is actually very bad. So we get a kind of muddled, typical English muddled version of consensus decision-making operating, which at the moment is working to most people's satisfaction, but needs to be sorted out in the long term.
Can you say more about what the muddle is?
I would say the muddle comes from bad facilitation, in that if you're making a decision rather than having a discussion, you need the decision to be brought out very easily so that people know, and you need somebody to go around and check that consensus has been found, and then I think you need to put that back to the group and do another check to make sure that the decisions that you think have been made have been made, and I don't think there's enough of that checking and not checking. And because it tends to be quite a small group that know each other quite well, it's kind of done in too informal a manner, I think, the actual consensus part of the decision making. One of the ways in which we're trying to tackle that is at the beginning of the weekend to put some kind of training into how to facilitate consensus decision making.
Mm. And does the reps have any rights or any power, you know, right to veto or?
Yes, we don't work in the way the Swedish people do with this kind of veto and walking out when you don't agree. What tends to happen is that you get a feel that basically you're happy, I think, with what goes on. But I think quite a lot of the unhappinesses or negativities don't really have a chance of coming out and being dealt with, and probably find other ways of coming out. There are other members of TP2000 here who have been to the reps meetings, and it might be useful to have other people coming in. This isn't, it's a discussion process. Because certainly River's been to some reps meetings. Have you, Azizi, been to any reps meetings?
No, I haven't.
Anybody else here been to any reps meetings? I think it's probably only... You've been to some reps, a reps meeting?
I think I even facilitated
one. Right, thank you. So maybe that question could be wider.
For me, I think we've got the best compromise I can think of between perfect democracy and not spending more time on decisions and actually doing the politics. And for me, that is always a trade-off, that perfect consensus takes a very long time. And the more important a decision is, the more time I'm willing to put into it. So if we had a thing from the government, should we stop doing actions, I would want us to put a lot more care into the decision than any decision we've made so far. But for decisions about do we have the camp in Aldermaston, in Faslane, things like that, I think we've got the level of democracy about right.
I don't understand. Just rephrase my question. Does the reps have any power at all? To like a right to vote or veto or any formal rights?
Yes, it is interesting because the way in which you place the question comes from a certain way of thinking.
Yeah.
And actually, the way it operates is that we all feel that we all have, I think, everybody there has an equal right. So it's not that they don't have a right or they do have a right or it's formalised in a vetoing kind of situation. We'd all be unhappy if somebody came, which hasn't happened, and there was such a conflict of interest that somebody felt that they even had to raise the question of veto. Do you know what I mean? Because, in fact, what actually happens is that We're genuinely trying to find a situation which we can all agree to. So it doesn't come to that. So if it came to that, I don't know quite how we would deal with it. Because there isn't a formal situation which says... somebody has more right or less right. What I'm really saying is everybody that's there has an equal say in what goes on.
Then someone
and then it depends on the group dynamics as to what actually happens and how it works out. And because we have a bottom line of consensus decision making, and because the people that are going there are wanting something to work, we've always managed to find a kind of way through, I think.
I'd like to say that what happens is that quite often a person who has a minority opinion will offer and will explicitly offer to back down. They will say, yeah, I've been heard, but I don't wish to push it any further. And what also sometimes happens is that everybody moves to a minority position because they hear it and they know that it's right. And both of those feel to me, having experienced that and having experienced this weekend lots of very strong vetoes, it feels actually more friendly that if I'm willing to give you your way because we've had a discussion, but then before I can say I'm willing to give you your way, you say I veto and you get your way. That way feels like something's been taken from me, which I was willing to give, and my generosity has not been recognised. So I think there are positives and negatives with both ways of doing things. And perhaps it just comes down to the fact that our way suits English people better than it would suit Swedish people. I don't know.
I feel that this is a kind of a crucial debate in many, many ways that we really haven't got our heads around within Trident Ploughshares. I think we've been lucky so far, in that we're still quite small, and there's an awful lot of goodwill, and because things have worked quite well, generally, and because there's usually enough people that want to make things work within a group, that it's kind of worked. And I think that we're reluctant to go to a veto situation because of the very thing that River's saying there. And at the same time, having read and talked to people, you know, about democracy and how, you know, if you don't formalise things, hidden structures can occur and all the rest of it. And knowing that what's working within Trident Ploughshares is working because of the kind of people that we've got there at the moment. So therefore it's very vulnerable in some ways. So it's still a big question mark. And interestingly enough, Stellan's group, I think this is right, came out of Trident Ploughshares because of the lack of that formal structure. And because one of the aims of Trident Ploughshares is to encourage and to be able to work with an international group, I think it's something that Trident Ploughshares as a campaign has to take on board. Because we can't say that's a Swedish thing, or that's an English thing, or that's a this thing, or that thing. We've got 13 nationalities. We're working in a very kind of ad hoc, muddly sort of way that is working for now. The problem is how to move into a better structure without destroying what's actually there and which is actually quite vulnerable still at the moment. Given, and I think this is the main thing, that most of the people within Trident Ploughshares 2000 are doing many other things with their life and do not want to spend the time required for what I would consider genuine, long-term, sustainable consensus decision-making, which takes time. So there is a trade-off. The way I think that we've looked at it in Trident Ploughshares is to try to say that each affinity group is autonomous and works on its, can work independently as it wants, and it's within that structure of the affinity group that they can set up their formalised vetoing, consensus decision making, and be really kind of clear and have exactly what that particular group wants, which is why we encourage groups to, we don't mind if groups break down and reform and change, so that they get a group of people who they can feel that they can get the structure which suits them and that they can work with really well. And these have tended sometimes to be, like we have a Belgian group, you know, and although we've got some mixed international groups, most of our nationals, I would say, are in groups with their own nationals. It's probably about half and half. So that's one way in which we can kind of muddle through, perhaps for a bit longer. But I don't know how much longer we can continue to muddle through. So I would say that is a major question mark, major problem.
Rowan, did you have a question?
It's not a clarification. I don't know whether it's a clarification
question.
No, I just wonder how the rest of this workshop will look like. Will it be discussion or will it just be questions?
It will be discussion once everybody's got their questions answered.
In smaller groups?
It could be in smaller groups. It's gotten quite large, yeah, I think that might be best. Although it would be difficult, maybe if we had divided the groups so there were people working on TP2000 in each group, so questions could be answered that way.
In that case, can I just, because I think I need to ask this question directly to MJ, maybe it's clarification. I was just wondering how much, generally in groups, I think there's often a problem of people being unwilling to participate in democracy. So even when there's a structure that's open and there, that very often people don't want power, don't want responsibility, don't want to take up leadership roles. And I wanted to say something about how willing and ready people are to sort of get involved in it.
I would say it's not bad for an organisation of that size, but as I said, there were 25 affinity groups, only 14, 18, I can't remember what exactly I wrote down, around 15 or so groups are really active. And at these reps meetings, we often only get 8 or 9 groups represented. so that there's an opportunity there for decision making and a weekend set aside to really come to grips with how TP2000 organisationally is working. And most people don't want to do it. Most people want to be spoon-fed. And it's interesting that the campaign was originally set up to be much more autonomous than it turned out to be. But because we work by consensus, we invited people before the first camp to a May meeting. And at that meeting, it was decided that the things that we had thought each affinity group was going to do for themselves, like cooking, legal support, press work, you know, each group would do its own stuff. They decided that that was not what they wanted. They wanted a centralised, so-called centralised, some kind of infrastructure, which they would default back to autonomy and independence, but they wanted the basic camp structure to be there for everybody. And that's what we kind of worked with. In fact, what our group has just done for Aldermaston, where we think all that might be dismantled by the police, because the police here are quite different from the police up in Scotland, is that Woodroses, that's my affinity group, has sent round a little notice to all the other affinity groups, reminding them of the bottom line of autonomy and self-sufficiency, reminding them that if the infrastructure gets taken down, each group has to be able to be ready and prepared to work on its own. And go to spokes councils and sort out things together, but you know, at least to be looking after their own affinity group, because we felt as an affinity group, other affinity groups hadn't kind of remembered that, taken that on. Is that sort of answering your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Can I add an answer to that? Because I mean, Angie is a long-term, very experienced activist, and I'm someone who came back into activism. Really, with TP2000, though I'd done a bit of road stuff before that. And from my point of view, having a service organisation that has the things there that our group can't do for itself is enabling. And as the group gets stronger, we will take on more roles and we will sort of cut the umbilical a bit. But having, knowing we don't have to do everything before we can do an action, enabled my action to take place, which it would not have done otherwise. And I know that's true of other affinity groups. So that was not something that was coercive or power thing, that was actually something that was enabling for me and for our group.
Yes, I didn't appreciate that so few my question is, how many people come to these meetings? Is it just those 8 reps out of the 25 groups, or can people who are not reps come too? And how many, in fact, do?
It's a reps meeting. If somebody asked if they could be an impartial observer, probably we'd ask the groups whether they minded that, and they'd probably say no, because it's a very open and accountable kind of campaign. But I think we've never had that anybody sort of say that they would like to come if they're not a pledger. Your question about how many people come, I mean, there have been reps meetings with as few as 8 people from 6 groups, I think. But with written submissions by various groups. And there have been reps meetings with as many as 40 people.
So is this, when you say 40 people, is this group sending more than one rep? Or is somebody from the group coming out of the
rep?
Yes,
but also core group members might go. So there might be people from, like, there might be 2 from a group and a core group member, you know.
And Turning the Tide sends a rep, and I don't know if anyone else does, but...
Mm. We are actually in the process of asking Turning the Tide trainers whether they'd form an affinity group of their own, so that they would, you know, be pledgers. But a lot of things take a lot of time. A lot of things that were set up to happen right at the beginning are only beginning to happen now, 2 years later, because Turning the Tide were asked originally whether they would be pledgers. But it wasn't appropriate at that time already at that time.
I brought it up at the Turning the Tide meeting and they weren't ready. But I didn't know you'd ask that again, because I was actually going to bring that up at the next Turning the Tide meeting, because I think that things have...
And that's starting, because Mike's just signed, for instance.
But I think they might now be willing to be an affinity group and pledges.
Yes, I wonder if you could say something about the role and the function of the core group, how you see it, because as I understood it, the core group launched the campaign, and so what positions do the core group take now, and what positions do the representatives
meet? Right, let's be really pragmatic about this. It came out of from one person originally. A letter went round, a core group came, self-choosing core group. At that very the very beginning of that self-choosing, there were two people who didn't get on with each other. So the first person that applied to be in the core group was chosen. Okay, that's all, what can I say, informal kind of self-choosing process. The people that do the work are not and make decisions are not necessarily in the core group. This is what's happened over time. Basically, in any organisation, if you're really honest about it, decisions are made all the time. Big decisions, little decisions. And it's usually the people that are doing the work that are doing the decisions. Some decisions people understand of as decisions, formal decisions that everybody needs to be consulted on. We've tried to take those out and put them into the reps meeting, to make sure that the decisions that we think everybody needs to be involved in, or if they see that they want a decision brought in, they can bring in to the reps meeting. Then those decisions are made at the reps meeting, the core group can implement them. But there are many day-to-day decisions that are made. Nobody's going to check every single press release with every single pledger. Do you know what I mean? The person that's in charge of press takes on that responsibility. The person that's in charge of the food takes on the responsibility. We're not going to go back to the situation which we had at the May meeting of having a huge consensus decision meeting on whether people could eat a bacon sandwich down the back field. You know, it's like an inappropriate use of time. basically, they're vegan, organic food, but you know, that's okay. So at the moment what we've got is 12 people in the core group. There's been quite a lot of in and out, and there's a kind of general policy that people shouldn't be in there too long. I'm moving out at the end of the camp. Other people have moved in and out. Nobody in there will have been in probably more than about 3 years. That's not formalised. But that's a kind of, how do you put it, a kind of culture growing up, an awareness that it's not sane for or sustainable for a group to have people, the same people doing the same jobs over a long period of time, but it's not formalised. There's, I would say, about 5 or 6 other people outside of the official core group, if you like, that are doing just as important work and making decisions, like somebody doing the website, somebody doing the opening of all the letters, the basic office work, somebody doing the treasury work. They're not, they don't have to be in the core group, they don't have the time, they don't want to be. One of them isn't even the pledger, but you know, agrees with all things. So do you see, it's quite complicated picture in a way. Is that answering your question?
Yeah.
Sort of.
I'm wondering about the communication with the authorities.
Mm.
What was the strategy for that, and all the things of escalation? And you have the demand that they start to disarm themselves in a certain day. All those things, and your personal view on that. How has that worked? And what could have been different?
Great in theory to begin with. Okay, we spent a lot of time setting up a group of 10 people outside of Trident Ploughshares, 2 people from the core group, Helen and myself, and about 8 other people who would be respectable from the government's point of view, who they could negotiate with if they didn't want to negotiate with so-called activists. They wanted to be a hidden group in the sense that they had other work to do. One was working with the Conference on Disarmament, one with the Middle Powers Initiative, quite sort of international level kind of work, and didn't necessarily want to be associated with direct activists. This was at the time, right at the beginning, when we had no idea whether the state would come down hard against us on conspiracy, which has proved not to be the case, which I thought would be the case, but we couldn't, you know, guarantee that. When it actually came down to doing the real hard work of actually formulating the open letters and carrying on the kind of dialogue and doing all, you know, working out the criteria for the demands to the government. That was done by the by that dialogue team, but probably only about three or four. What's actually happened now is that there's probably only three people that actually now writes those letters and cooperates by email to get them going, because they're the ones that had most of the ideas. That dialogue and negotiation letter is checked out by the core group, just to kind of, because they're from quite a few affinity groups, and if there's going to be anything wrong with them, you know, that group can usually kind of, you know, work it out. And then they go. If any affinity group had any problem, those letters are put onto the internet, and they go out usually in pledges mailings. They don't always go out in pledges mailings. We've been quite bad about that. Some of them have gone out and some of them haven't. But they're all up on the website for people, and if anybody wants a copy of them, they can have them. If any group had a problem with the way in which those letters were going, they could raise that at any time, or at a reps meeting. And that's something that we stress. If any group or any individual within the campaign has any problems at all, they all have the names and addresses of all the people in the campaign, so they can write to them all. You know, there's no rule against raising anything that anybody wants to if they have any problems with that. The letters have been very useful on an international level. The two that have had the most work put into them were produced as open letters and published in quite large numbers and ended up at the Conference on Disarmament at the UN, so that a lot of the ambassadors working on disarmament issues have got them. We've also done a few articles based on the kind of criminality of British defence policy, which have gone into various publications, again, which UN ambassadors see and things like that. And we know from contacts that we've got that it's being talked about, and that the Ministry of Defence and the Foreign Office are finding the questions that we're continually asking them very embarrassing and difficult to answer. So I would say on that level it's quite useful. And it's been very useful with the parliamentary questions that are continually being put to our TAME MPs, and we're getting some very useful answers back. All of that stuff feeds into other groups that are doing lobbying. The forum for that discussion is probably the World Court Project in this country, George Fairbrother and the World Court Project, who then gets that out onto the Abolition 2000, Global 2000. Mailings and things.
Before we take the next question, I'd like for people to think, if you have a question that you really need to hear an answer specifically from Andrew, or if it could be heard from one of the other people that's involved in the action, because I'd really like us to split into groups soon. So Susie's got a question, and then after that, you have one also. Okay.
My question's to do with burnout, and how much does it fall on the same people again, and do they then burn out, or what's the workload like?
Nobody's burnt out yet, as far as I know. There's been several people close to it, and people are aware of it, and there are continual requests for more people to take on more work. This is done within the light of trying not to put people off, in the sense that River was talking about. A lot of groups need quite a lot of support and help in order to get established just as a group. If they're asked to contribute too much to the overall organisation, then they're going to fall away and go. And there's a certain feeling that you need to do about how much you can ask of people and how much you can't, because otherwise the groups aren't even going to be there, so you know. and the more you ask them to contribute in the way of organisational meeting stuff, the more likely they are to go away. So there's a kind of fine line to be drawn. I would say a lot of work is done by three or four people, and that is known to be unhealthy, and more delegation is kind of being asked for and being got. on the bright side, there's a lot of people doing lots of different things and, you know, lots of things coming up. So I think kind of burnout's under control, but we need more people to do more things.
Yeah. Is there any formal rules on who is selected to be on the core group or the negotiation or dialogue team?
I don't know what one would consider formal. There's no kind of book of rules. What's gone out in some of the pledges mailings is that anybody are for discussion at the reps meetings is questions like, these are the people on the core group at the moment. Are you happy with their work? Do you want any of them to go? Do you want other people to come in? Along with requests for more people to be on the core group and more people to do more work. But there's also, it goes alongside this other thing that the core group is like an affinity group. And in order to be effective and to work well, they need to be able to work as a group together. So that the core group that we have would not accept on that group somebody who they couldn't work with. Okay? In the sense that an affinity group can't work if you haven't got people that want to be in there. But what's actually happened is that that's never happened. We've never had somebody who's been asked to go on the core group or who wanted to go on the core group that hasn't been there. But that was a safety mechanism that they wanted, that the core group wanted, that they wanted to make sure that they had a group that they could all work with. Whether that would remain like that or not, nothing is cast in stone. It's all up to the people within the campaign to change and direct it and to alter it. And one of the things I was very sad about was that, if I can be frank about that, is that your group actually went out of the process rather than staying in there and working a way in which your very valid and useful ideas could somehow come in on the democracy level, and that you work that way with the process and stayed with it long enough to create those changes. But maybe we'll have other people that will come in and do that, because it's something that I think that the campaign needs.
The building of affinity groups within the peace movement, if they're sustainable and based locally, which many of them are, if we're serious about a non-military defence, we need to have people who know how to confront evil, work together, and actually stop crimes from being committed or their country being taken or whatever in a non-violent way. And it's a kind of long-term process of building up civil defence as opposed to military defence. And also that those people within the peace movement should see themselves as part of a global movement in all sorts of different ways, so that affinity group could be ready to do anything locally that they felt needed to be done. So do you see what I mean? There's a lot of kind of things moving in here. I didn't see it as a straight, small, little Plowshares group. But that's in my head. I don't know how much of that's in other people's head.
In relation to that, I don't know if I may have been satisfied with the goals, because I would like, or if it can aim at that, like a clear goal of the reasons it maybe that of the global issues, and in that sense the relation with the militarism or the nuclear weapons and the third world starvation. As the real goals.
Well,
and maybe I can see that in connection to the first issue and the fourth, the law breaking. It's not outspoken so much.
What the hunger, third world thing is not as outspoken.
Yeah, if that could have been one goal. Or
I think that that's a motivator for why a lot of people get involved in anti-nuclear stuff or anti-war stuff, the incredible waste of resources. But it certainly wasn't a primary link. The campaign was
came out, apart from coming out of the Ploughshares movement, it also came out of the whole UN movement of trying to prevent conflict and people working together in fellowship, out of which international humanitarian law has come. And it came directly after the International Court of Justice, which had been a 10-year campaign, which you're probably aware of, against the power of these nuclear weapon states, which had won this amazing advisory opinion, which basically said nuclear weapons are illegal, and needed implementation in order, and much more publicity, and many more people coming behind it, in order to force the nuclear weapon states to admit what everybody already knew anyway, that because they're so immoral, they're basically illegal. So it was coming out of that stream, so that the hunger, the third world development, the waste of resources, there's loads of other things that are there as motivators for individual people, but they weren't put in into the handbook really as major issues.
I would.
There's room for those, but when you hear people in the court, that's brilliant. That is where you get the vitality from each individual. And in a way, maybe it's good that they're not put in there, because if you put everything into something, it doesn't allow people to bring up all the stuff that really is motivating them. But if you go and listen to the court cases, it's wonderful stuff, really amazing stuff, and a lot of it is about.
But I would criticize it anyway. Some kind of ethical direction, even though it doesn't have to be so specific or that people have to agree, but in general, in accordance with all those excellent talks about the law thing and the value.
Oh, well, actually, if you look very carefully, wherever the law is mentioned, morality is always mentioned. So that was very carefully put in the very first open letter. Most of the letters you'll see, along with legal, you'll see and moral. We do carefully keep them together. If they aren't there, it's a mistake. And in the handbook, there is it, but we don't go into the details about the morality, because in a way, you know, everybody has their own moral slant on it. They come from a different religion or a different spiritual background or whatever. But in the handbook, anyway, there was quite a lot on the different religions. Mm-hmm. And why they were against nuclear weapons and things. But every time legal's there, you've got legal and moral. And every time that we mention legality and the laws, we say that the law only has legitimacy if it's based on common morality. Because laws could just be crap. You know, I'm not going to go and approve of laws that are immoral. But the point is, when you do have a whole body of law, like the international humanitarian law, you should use it, I think. You know, I actually think that a society, it is a way of resolving conflicts to go to courts rather than fighting it out on the streets. I see it as an improvement. Not one that I would aim for in a utopia, but definitely one that is worth, you know, going for in the medium term, having some laws that respect.
Utopia.
How far do you think the campaign has got? I mean, how big do you think it should grow before you can reach your aims compared to how big it is now?
I'm very pragmatic about movements and campaigns. They go on until the energy and spirit moves out and into something else. And you know, then you don't. I don't think you build a movement and a campaign thinking that has got to stay, you know, forever. There's going to be even more horrendous conflicts that are going to be coming up on the world stage in the next 10 years that could make this totally irrelevant, you know. But the point is that what isn't irrelevant is people empowering themselves, learning skills, working in small groups, because that, whatever you're working on, is what's needed, and being connected internationally with movements and other that this feeling that we're working as global citizens on an issue together, and I'm happy then to go as a global citizen to another country and do that, and I think that's
criticism, which is not directed towards TP2000 or TP, maybe you say now, but it might be interesting. It's like, I think it's a lot of excellent organizing, and it's good guidelines, people are learning skills, developing new ideas, and all that stuff. All this is happening, but the Orthodox plowshares haven't been good at connecting to this, building bridges. So I think Annika did a great job in Sweden. She got like 3 affinity groups over to TP2000. Couple of years ago, you know, and Rowan had done a great job at this gathering to invite people from TP2000, but we have been really bad, the Orthodox parts have been really bad at, you know, the oldies, you know, this is a new plowshare campaign, and they're using some new methods, some new ideas, something like that. Resistance network from 89, and the national plowshare movements haven't really any good bridges which could help support the TP campaign, or to create some kind of community together, you know. It has been some and Rowan's, but somehow it's a great failure from us, from the Orthodox Church.
Why do you think that is? I've got a theory about it.
Yeah, please.
Well, no, what's your theory?
I don't have a theory. I can see that we could have done that, but I don't have a...
My theory is that it's not a pure plowshares. In the sense of a small dedicated group doing maximum disarmament. Resisting in prison as a matter of course, rather than into the loops, you know, and done in that, and nor has it come out of a Catholic worker kind of situation, or a group that has worked long time and is thinking about it for a long time in the future. Therefore, that's been it's brought in too many. If you looked at it on some levels, you could say, how is it different from any CND demonstration? Like the blockade in February, there were blockades like that going on in the 80s. You know, why call it Russians? So I think that might be part of the problem. The kind of,
but why would that be a problem?
Because I think that the commitment, the long-term sustainability and the experience of the plowshares movement is greatly needed within Trident Plowshares. So what I'd like to know is what we can do in order to make it better. See, we failed in a way with the Swedish groups because there wasn't enough time or clarity about the democracy debate. They withdrew rather than coming on.
All three groups have
all three groups because of that.
And the Swedish TP2000 coordinating group have withdrawn now.
Right. But they haven't done that officially.
Groups.
They haven't said withdraw our names from the pledges.
Yes, yeah.
In practice they have, because they haven't been coming over.
And then they made the decision last year.
So there's a communication.
We have 5 minutes.
What do you think we can do in order to, or is it worthwhile trying to keep that or keep people like that on board?
another
formally pulled out?
Affinity
what about
groups.
The other ones?
Everyone have formally moved out, like I think it was in November, all groups and all individuals, and the Cornetti group, the Swedish community.
Which is the Corpus Christi, Bread La Palms, which is that one?
After then it was Igis group.
Basis.
Yes.
But it would be good if, in addition, if the Trident, if the Plowshare movement can make a connection between your thing here and whenever those arms are sold in third world countries where they're deprived of the money necessary for social services, and automatically we make the connections. Because we are the market.
Yes.
You produce it and we consume it, and if you do, if we have those arms, they will always find occasions to create war so that the arms will be consumed. You know what I mean? Because you, with arms you have to use it in order to have a repeat order. And so when you sell arms, the first world government will create foreign policies that will create conflict later on, so that those arms will be used.
I don't find that there's a problem with making the links or doing that in writing or papers or within the arms trade. What is very difficult, I think, when we're talking about global citizens and direct action, is there a you know, I've just been to Japan. Okay, they have loads of anti-nuclear stuff. You know, their peace movement is massively big. They're involved in trying to get rid of the American bases there, which are the biggest American bases in the whole world outside of America. I felt diffident and not very easy about going there and saying, would some of you Japanese like to become Trident Plowshare soldiers and come protest about British nuclear weapons, you know? And yet, I know jolly well that if that's done in the right way, and we had some discussions about it, one, it would help our campaign here a lot to have Japanese people coming and talking directly in the course about Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and two, it would revitalize their movement there, which is has been doing the same kind of things and doesn't have an international connection. But it's very arrogant and presumptuous to go to another country and say, come over to my country. And the only way I think it kind of works is if you say, we'll send some of our activists over to you and help work with you for 6 months and get involved and get arrested and go to your prisons. If you will come over and do that. Now that's what we've done with Belgium, but we haven't done it with anyone else, and I'm beginning to try to work with this with Japan. But that also means, like, we've got to, you know, because that's real global citizenship. I don't think you can possibly, you've got to work out how they can use what they're doing in your country, in their country. Now, you did that in Sweden. You weren't part of Trident Plowshares, in fact, Annika. You know, by that time you'd withdrawn. And that was a shame, because what actually happened is that everything came, you got loads of publicity and stuff in Sweden, but it, in a way it didn't have very much place to go to, because it had already withdrawn from Trident Plowshares and we couldn't give it full backing. We gave it support, but not full backing. Whereas we could have done so much more on that whole stuff, like, you know, like the documentaries that came out of the Belgian group with the Finns, who were based in Belgium, and the Dutch, you know, that built into their campaign in Belgium and into Britain. You know, and that's what I'd like to see whether we could do. But like, how do you do it with America? For
okay,
instance,
we have
got
to
so many
stop
things going on
here.
It's just getting interesting. But have you got any ideas on
that? So we're done.
I'm not connected with the Plowshares movement in the States at all. But I am with some anti-nuclear folks who do about a test site stuff. So I can't say anything about the Plowshares. But I think that the cross-cultural thing is, you know, with doing an exchange with Japan or with Americans or anywhere, I think it's brilliant. I mean, that's really the nice thing that the global movement against anything, whether it's against globalization or against nuclear, not against nuclear disarmament, against cooperation. I think that that's really the next step that we need to take. Learn from each other, and you know, some strategies used in the States aren't going to work outside of the States, but some will. And you know, I'm learning a lot here from you know things that work in Sweden.
I think
we can take that back. So,
if
that's crucial.
We're being asked.
Shall I start as I was in group one and taking notes? Angie clarified the goals and aims of Trident Plowshares, which included, amongst other things, revitalising the direct action part of the peace movement and includes developing the long-term non-violent skills as part of an alternative to the current military model. In other words, if we want to create a new society that's not based on a military model, you need people aware of non-violence methods and experienced in using them and so on. The law, we talked about how the law that although this Trident Plowshares is often a legal campaign, that and that's a good way to do things if the law is based on good values. But if you've got a really crap law, then there's a problem. So Trident Plowshares makes always the connection between the law and the morality because that's important. Interestingly, the Orthodox Plowshares have not been good at supporting Trident Plowshares. And we discussed maybe this is because it's not come out of the Orthodox Plowshares or Catholic, it's not come out of, but it's also not the sort of model of the Orthodox Plowshares or Catholic Worker Maximum Action, sort of having a maximum action followed by maximum action. Rather, it's got big sort of less maximum actions, some of the big demos, which are more like some of the big C&D things, and it's kind of doesn't look like some of the traditional character stuff. Also I found very interesting, in Belgium, when the Belgium Plowshares groups have their meetings, there's a person going from Trident Plowshares 2000 to those meetings, and vice versa, so that although there are Belgium Trident Plowshare groups, there's a more formal connection between the two. And that's meant that there's been a really good working relationship and people supporting each other's actions in a very good way. And I'm to give this to the note taker of the whole meeting.
Does someone from group two want to talk?
Two, did we? Since Andy asked for a criticism, I just report that the criticism we were having, we were only having time for a go-round. As far as I understand, what was said in the go-round, in my view. One thing was that it's a kind of cultural thing that we do not have the time or energy to be democratic enough when it is serious issues where we should be democratic. It's not so much a problem of the teeth of the thousand, but the cultural problem. Another point was that consensus in itself is difficult and time-consuming. Another point was that it is kind of not enough of a focus of the disarming actions, but on actions that are a bit difficult to understand. The fence cutting in itself, or such actions. Another point was that when you try to funnel people into a special way of acting, you will lose a lot of people that otherwise would take part. So that's a tricky thing then. Other points on criticism was that it is too law-oriented, the campaign as such, and a kind of prison avoidance where bail seems to be the preferred option, and prison as a challenge is not really used. The internal democracy is informal in a way that it gives room for manipulation of opinions, which might be a problem when there is a stage of negotiation with the government where the campaign is really at the critical stage. Anyone from the group want to clarify any criticism?
Time left there?
No, left the other.
1 minute.
Okay. Group number two.
We talked mainly on the decision-making process as well, consensus and so on. Rowan and I felt that us as an affinity group weren't invited enough or pushed enough to be part of the representatives meeting. We hadn't had any invitation for this meeting, for instance. Another thing is that maybe everybody is happy with the muddle because they don't have they don't realize that it's not really democratic. They feel it is democratic, but don't know that it could be better. And that it's hard to understand the different other cultures. To understand the Swedish culture, if you see it happening, or if somebody proposes to go into small groups, the first reaction will often be that it will cost too much time and it will complicate things, and you do not see the benefits. Maybe. Am I being clear here? At all? Ah, okay.
Clarify on that first point. I think for me there's a confusion around our invitation as an affinity group into TP 2000 because I think it's confused because I'm not a pledger and therefore that interferes with their process and I think it's just not very clear.
Mm.
And you're staying.
Yeah, I'm staying tonight. Yeah,
so tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you.